Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic. And after that great build-up, now I'll have to come up to expectations. I hope you don't expect too much. I'm just another alcoholic, the same as anybody else, and I'm very happy to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not like Alcoholics Anonymous when I came to it at the beginning, because I wasn't an alcoholic when I came here, but two people made me an alcoholic. However, I do want to congratulate the roundup on the 23rd year. And I think you must be doing something right to have 23 consecutive years and still a lot of people coming. So I think it's a good part. These roundups and conventions and get-togethers that we have, I think, are a good part of our fellowship, because they get us together, have hugs and kisses. I got more hugs and kisses here than I ever got anywhere else. I think it's a very friendly place. I'm very happy to be here, and I want to thank Mel for inviting me here, and I want to thank Rita for what she has done for me this weekend, and not forgetting Mary. Mary came over to meet me, of course, and I was very kind of wondering when I was coming in. I thought I had given Rita the wrong time if the plane was arriving, because I didn't know that you were an hour's different in time. And I thought, well, my God, they'd be here an hour ago waiting for me, and no sign of them. I said, they'd be gone home again. So all I could do was get a cab and come in. But no, Mary was there and she was shouting away down at the end, here I am, come here. And then without even asking my permission, she brought me to a meeting. She said, yeah, we're going to a meeting. So I said, okay, that's my boy. We were at a beautiful meeting. I must say, in a hospital, it was a beautiful meeting. It was a tradition meeting. And I think it was extremely good to hear the traditions being read. I think it's so important to us. And I also like to hear the concepts read. And Rita is right in what she says, that the concepts seem to be a terrific crossword puzzle when you read them first. It seems to be terribly difficult. It was for me, maybe not for you, but very hard to understand it. And I didn't properly understand it unless I started to work in it. And I think the same thing applies to our traditions. If we start to work in service, we'll soon find out how important our traditions are. However, I have something else to say, that I'd never been at a roundup before or a convention where I heard a lady standing up offering herself to somebody in a room tonight. I think that's... Well, I think that's extremely friendly. I hope you find somebody. We do all hear that we have to change our lifestyle when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, but it looked like it today because nobody jumped up, and I couldn't understand that. Well, however, maybe you know by now I'm a foreigner. And I was born in Ireland, and I was not in a dysfunctional family as far as I know. We had a loving family. My mother died when I was 5, and my father reared 5 of us after that. And we lived in a farm. And in a farm is a lot different to living in a city. It's more spiritual, I think, than anywhere else. We all pray together. And I like that, and I often miss that. As a family, we pray together, we eat together, and I think the family spirit was there. And I always like that, and I like to go into a house where they eat together and they pray together and have a family spirit, because we can't carry on without the family spirit. And I do believe that we have a family spirit in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really a togetherness that I never experienced in anything before. I think it was beautiful. I didn't start drinking too early in life, but I used to sip the bottoms of glasses when I was a child. And somehow I liked it. I don't know why I liked it or what, but I liked it. And when I did, if there was anybody in, there wasn't very much drinking in our house, but if there was anybody in and there was Guinness or Stout or wine especially, I liked wine a lot. And the night my mother was waked, I remember somebody gave me a glass of wine to keep me quiet because I was hysterical. And I loved the taste of that wine. And if I went any place after that and anybody asked me to have something, I would say wine. And I got the wine and nobody ever said no. But then going to school and getting bigger and that kind of thing, that went out the door. And I went down to another part of the country and at the age of 19, or at the age of 17, and at the age of 19 I had my first drink, as I would consider my first drink. And it was brandy in a ginger, brandy and orange juice, and I remember it very well. And I heard an Alcoholics Anonymous, if you remember your first drink, the chances are you're an alcoholic. And I remember every second of that. And I had the second one, and I was hiding it that night. I didn't want anybody to see me. Now, it didn't become a problem with me at least for 6 or 8 years afterwards, and I don't remember exactly. I haven't that great a memory now, and I hadn't that great a memory even when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, because a lot of things happened in my life that I never came back, and I did a lot of drinking. But I got into trouble with my boss 12 years after. And I was drinking then at this time every night, and I wasn't able to manage properly. I wasn't getting enough of money, and it's hard to keep up this kind of drinking I was doing, so I had to help myself from this till. And there was two bosses, one was me and the other was him, and he won out. And I had to leave. Now, I wasn't told to leave, but I left because I was afraid that I would be fired. And I went to another job for 5 years, which was another disaster. Up there, I was drinking continuously, round the clock, really. And in the morning, I would go uptown for a drink. Then when that would wear off, I'd go up for more. And all day long, I'd have something to drink. Not maybe an awful lot, but I had something to drink. And then I went on it at night and again. But one morning, I had gone out the country road with my boss's car, and I ran down a child. And all I could remember was this child going up in the air, and I thought I had him killed. And I was very frightened, and along came a priest in a car, and he picked the two of us up and brought us into town. And I was very frightened at that time, because I knew perfectly well that it was my drinking that had all this done. And my boss didn't say much, but he did bring the child to the doctor, and the doctor said the child was not hurt. And that caused a little bit of trouble. He found out a lot of things from there, because small towns in Ireland talk enough. Small towns here talk a lot. But smaller towns in Ireland talk a lot more, I think. But they heard more about me than he ever knew. Anyhow, he did say to me sometime that if I didn't stop drinking, that I would have to leave. And an alcoholic doesn't like to be told that. An alcoholic doesn't like to be told anything, really, I guess. Another part of it, but I decided I'd go to England. Now, I had been over in England several times on a vacation, so I knew where I was going to, because I had lots of relations in England, and they came over to our home every year. So I was going over to them anyhow. So I went over and got a job. I got a job first in a grocery store, and I didn't like the manager at all. I didn't like what he was telling me, and I didn't like to be told what to do. And I had a row with him, and that was it. He fired me. I was kind of upset about that, but my cousin said to me, don't be upset about that. There's loads of jobs here. All you have to do is go out and get another one. So I went down to the bus station, and I got a job as a conductor on the buses. Now, a conductor on the buses in England was just an alcoholic's paradise, because anybody that wanted to drink could go in off the bus, go into a bar, because the buses stopped at a bar each. At the end of each line was a bar. And I went into the bar and had a few drinks, and I, at the beginning, couldn't get used to the drinking the pints of beer, but I did get used to them after a while. I joined a few Catholic clubs that when I was there, I had our own parish. I thought it was wiser, because everybody I knew was in this club, and I don't think I was too happy about joining it, but, you know, just to cover up. I went down, I joined the club, and I wanted to let everybody see I was just great, and but that club, there was the priest always there, and I didn't want him to see me drinking too much. And I was never satisfied, but later on I joined the Knights of Columba. And that was opened a bit longer at night time. They would stay open till 12 o'clock, 11, 12 o'clock, and sometimes if there was a dance there, they'd stay open till 2. So I was really delighted with that. This was great. I could finish work at 11 o'clock and go up there and have a few hours up there drinking. And after having several drinks all day long on the bus. And then I found another club it was a Protestant club that was open all night, and I joined the Protestant club. So I would go to the Catholic club first, and then I would go down and I would go into the Protestant club, and I would stay there as long as I felt like it. I don't know what the people that I was living with at the time thought about all that, but nobody mentioned anything to me. But to me it was okay. However, how I heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, was that I had three sisters here, and my elder sister, I can barely remember her going to the States, and she wrote to me saying she wanted to come back to see us all before she gets too old. And would I come over to see her? And I said I would. So I got over to see her, and we had 2 weeks in Ireland together. She was staying for 6 weeks altogether, but all I could stay was for two. And I was driving her around to see the different people that she wanted to see before she left. And also people were giving her names and addresses of their relations in different counties at home. And we went to see those people. And every place I went to, the bottle was out. I thought this was great. The bottle was out every time, and I always had a big shot of whiskey. And she wasn't too happy about the way I was drinking. And she said to me one day, when I would go to a town, I would stop the car and I'd run in someplace and have a shot of whiskey and a bottle of stout and out again. And she said to me one day, why are you going in so often to these saloons? And I said, I want to go to the bathroom. And she said, what's the matter, your bad kidneys or something? So I said, no, I just have to go to the bathroom, and but I don't drink much when I'm back working. And it went off like that, and she went home, and I went back, and she asked me, she wrote to me later on and asked me would I like to come to the United States. And I thought for a while, and I said, well, she's too bossy, and I don't want to go over there to them in the United States, because they'll boss me around. I'm free in England, nobody takes any notice of what I do, nobody bosses me around, I can go in and drink if I want to. And the only thing I was worried about at that time was to drink. This was the only bossing I was afraid of, because it's trying to stop me from drinking. And she wrote back and forth again to me, and at long last I decided I would come. So I came here on May the 10th, 1959, a fully blown alcoholic. I should have been going back, I was 40 years of age then. Practically. And they met me at the airport, and my other sister and her husband brought me out to live in Flatbush in Brooklyn. And I went in that morning to their house, and my brother-in-law gave me my first drink in America, and that was a Tom, not a, I forget what it was now. It was, not a Tom Collins, something else anyhow. But however, I only got one drink all day long. I was absolutely fainting because I really wanted something else. This had started up the compulsion from once I took that drink, which I didn't understand anyhow. And I was expecting something more sometime or another, and I didn't get any more. And Lord, I said, this is going to be some misery here living in this place. I don't know why I was going to come over here at all. I wish I hadn't come. That was my first day. I was wishing I hadn't come. And my sister told me there that I would have to stay there for a while, that I couldn't get a job, that I wasn't looking that good, and that she'd have to build me up before I got a job anywhere. And I didn't think that at all. I thought I looked great. And she didn't think anything about that. She thought I was looking terrible. And she did talk. She never stopped talking about the drinking. But I had such many relations here that they were writing in and calling me and asking me to come to visit them, and they all came with me because I didn't know where I was. And every time I went into a house, it was just great to see their liquor cabinets, how they'd open this liquor cabinet and ask you, what would you have? Now, that couldn't be better to any alcoholic, any other alcoholic. It was just great, and it's just what an alcoholic would like. And I kept drinking every time, all day long. And one day she said to me, how come you're drinking so much? I said, I don't drink much. She said, what are you talking about? You drank more than anybody else in such a day we were out in such a house. And I said, well, I guess it's because I'm not used to it here, and I don't drink much at all. Well, she said, I don't know, but it seems to me that you drink an awful lot, because she said, everybody else was drunk and you were sober. And I can't believe it. So I thought this was great to be sober and have the rest of them getting drunk. They weren't as good as me, because they couldn't hold the liquor. And I thought it was a great achievement for anybody not to get drunk. And instead of that, she saw it in a different way altogether. However, anyhow, I came uptown to New York to one day. Somebody brought me up to look for a job. I didn't really want to go for a job at this time. I had no notion of going to work. It was another thing I hadn't in mind. I don't know what I was going to do, but I hadn't any notion of going to work. And one day she decided that maybe I should go and look for a job, that I'd be better off working and you'd be happier and all this kind of thing. But she was right in what she was saying. But afterwards, she was sorry she sent me up here. But I got a job with a bank, a big bank downtown New York. And the first job they gave me was working with the porters. Now, they were asking me for, you know, what I could do, was I skilled or all this. I didn't know what they were asking me about, what they were talking about. But anyhow, they gave me this job. And they gave me the first morning a dirty gray uniform that I didn't like. It was cold. And then they asked me if I'd wash out a bathroom, and they gave me a big bucket and told me to fill it with hot water and give me a gallon of soap to put into it. And I thought they meant to put the whole gallon of soap in. So I put the whole gallon of liquid soap into this bucket of water and this big mop. And it was so big and heavy, I'd never seen something like this before. And I put it into it and pounced it up and down, and up comes the suds. So I threw the bucket of water on the floor and flopped this thing around as much as I could. And it was terrible. I couldn't get it dried up. It was awful. And the suds were all up halfway up the room. And people were coming into work. And one guy with his brand new suit, as I thought it was, he slithered and fell. And he was very hurt. He was very annoyed about it. And in no time, there were about five or six guys came in and ushered me out. And told me they'd finish, and closed the door, and that was it. I never heard a word about it afterwards. I went out and went for coffee someplace, and I never heard a word about it afterwards. But that wasn't all my problem or my trouble there. I still was drinking. I was going home at night and I'm getting into trouble all the time when I went out to Brooklyn. Never stopped talking to me about the way I was drinking or what is the matter with you. And you know, it is terribly hard to be asked what is the matter, but you know, I knew there was something the matter. But I couldn't know what it was. And I couldn't stop. And I had taken so many pledges in Ireland that, you know, I thought a pledge was... It was wicked to have to go through a pledge. And I never kept it for more than 2 or 3 weeks. I used to take it for 2 years at a time at the beginning, which never lasted for anything, only 2 or 3 weeks. The last pledge I took in Ireland was I went to a monastery to take this pledge, and I cycled 5 miles from the monastery to the nearest bar, and that was the end of that. And I never went for a pledge after that, but I thought that, you know, I didn't want to take a pledge here. I was scared of it. But however, I kept on drinking, of course, then anyway, when I go up to town. But one day, one of the elevator operators died. He died on the car. And everybody was talking about this poor guy dying. And the manager came up and asked me, would I like to take the job on the car? I didn't know what he meant by all this. Did he want me to die too? Of what? I was kind of, you know, my thinking wasn't that good. And when I went into the office, they gave me a uniform, and that uniform belonged to the guy on the car. And I said, oh my God, that's it. They want to do me in. They also gave me his hat, but I wouldn't wear his hat. And I got into the cars, and they were training me how to drive these things up and down. They weren't electric. They were these manual things. And I'd go up to these manual things and I'd rush up to a floor and I couldn't bring it in for a landing if I tried. It was absolutely impossible for me to bring it anywhere near the proper landing. I'd have it either higher or lower. And when there was people on the car, they'd be getting off, they'd hit their shoes against the tip of the floor, and or else it'd be too high, they'd fall down. And really, I had an awful time, and I couldn't make out what the hell was wrong with me. But one day, coming down, people were coming from work. It was about 5 o'clock, and a lot of people got on my car. And there were so many got on, I wouldn't stop anybody from getting on the car. There was only so many you were supposed to let on, but when they came in, oh, come on, I'll let them in, and whiz goes the car down to the very bottom. And I heard the chains rattling and this bottom scraping, and out goes the lights. I didn't know where I was. So I had driven it down into the pit. And I didn't know what was going to happen. And the next thing was I heard over the speaker a voice coming and saying, where are you? And I said, I don't know. No light made me feel... When there was no light, the people in the car got very unhappy. And I couldn't keep them. I was new to the country, and I couldn't keep them very happy. I didn't care whether they got happy or sad. But I was still scared because I didn't know would I come out of that place. But he told me what to do, and I did. And up comes the car to the landing, up to the main floor. The yard got out, and the yard congratulated me on the good job I did and said, you have your ups and downs. And that was... They all went off, and I said, oh my God, what am I going to do now? They'll fire me surely after that. That's two groups already, and I'll see you 6 weeks yet. And the next morning when I came in, the starter was there, and he said, oh, I heard you into the pit last night. I said, yes. Oh, he said, don't worry at all about it. He said, everybody does it. Oh, thank God, everybody does it, and I'll not be fired. So that went on okay, so I wasn't fired. But you know, an alcoholic is not happy, and I wasn't happy. No matter where I was, I thought I should be fired. And they weren't doing the right thing when they weren't firing me, and I didn't know what was wrong. And you know, that I left myself, when 6 months was up there, they asked me, would I like to go down to Wall Street? And to go into the office in Wall Street and do documentary exchanges from Federal Reserve Bank to the First National City Bank every day. And I would have to go five or six times a day, hail, rain or snow, it didn't matter. Well, anyhow, I thought this would be a lot nicer. But now they reduced my wages because I had gone into the bank and it wasn't to, I had to start off again. And I wasn't happy about that. But anyhow, I brought these documents to the Federal Reserve and money, checks and all kinds of different things. And any time I had cash with me or something that was very important, I didn't know what I was bringing half the time. And they'd send two armed guards with me, and I'd walk with these armed guards, and I didn't know what they were sending these for. But anyhow, I guess it was insurance purposes, but anyhow, one day I was out giving this money and stuff out, and I lost $500,000. And that surely was enough to be fired. And when I came in, the phone was ringing all over the place, and all these guys were calling me, Jimmy, somebody for the phone. Jimmy, somebody wants to answer the phone. And boy, oh boy, I didn't know what was happening. And the guy said to me, what did you do with the money? It was from the Bank of London, too. And I said, I didn't get any money. Well, he called the bank, and the bank said, it was given to me, and what happened? So they all began to arrive to see me. I became very popular that afternoon. A lot more so than I ever thought before. But the girl that gave me the check, she said, you remember me giving it to you, don't you? And I said, no, I didn't. I didn't get that check from you. And that poor child really was really upset and terribly upset. And they were believing me above her. And I often thought of it since, if I only knew who she was, I would write her a letter and apologize to her. Whoever she is, I don't know. Or I didn't even know her. And when that was over, I thought, well, there's no way out of here now. I've got to be fired for this. Well, the $500,000 showed up the next day, evidently, and they were fined 3% because it was late. But I never heard anything about it, or nobody ever said anything to me about it. And I said, I wonder what I've got to do to be fired from here. But I guess they were making so much money then, and they had so many employees there, that there was two or three people to do every job. Anyhow, I met a guy in a bar one day in 3rd Avenue, and I thought, he said to me, after a few drinks, of course, because you know the way you get talkative after a few drinks, I always settle down when I got a few drinks. And he said to me, you should come and work with my store. And I said, have you got a store? He said, yes. We have a corporation up in Tudor City, and he said, you can come up and work with me. He said, and the bank isn't much of a job. He said, you get more money in our place. So I thought this over. This guy was very decent. He bought me an offer of drinks that night. And I thought, well, he's worth knowing. And I went home, and I mentioned it when I went home, but they told me that I'm a big boy now, and you have got to make up your own mind. I didn't like that. I always liked somebody to tell me and to agree with what I wanted to do, and then I'd blame them if it was wrong. But I had to make up my mind, and I decided I would go up after 2 weeks pondering over this and not sleeping at night time and coming in drunk and causing trouble. I burned two tables belonging to my sister with cigarettes. And another place that had thrown you out in your heel, you know, but they didn't. I guess they had some compassion for me someplace or another. But when I was up there in this shop, at this store, I began to drink in the daytime again. And I knew before anything might happen, I would be better off to try and look for an apartment. So in 3rd Avenue, where I used to go to drink, I met a couple of Irish guys. And they were nearly all Irish guys that were in bars, anyhow, in 3rd Avenue. And I became very friendly with them because they'd give me a drink now and again. It's very important to be friendly when you're an alcoholic. And also you want to lend $5 or $10 now and again, you know, and you've got to treat them with respect. And I treated them with respect, and this guy told me, I was telling him about my problem with my sister. And she doesn't understand nothing. I said, she doesn't understand anybody. And they would tell me, well, you should leave that house altogether, for heaven's sake, he said. And I had to do the same thing. I was living with my aunt, and I couldn't stand her at all. I had to leave. And I agreed with them. So up I came to the Bronx, and went into this apartment, which was really a cockroach-infested apartment. It was in a basement, and there was big tubes and pipes going through the basement. And there was cockroaches, and I'm sure they were as big as mice walking around there. And it was an awful place. But, you know, I was glad I was free. And I could go down to the bar now, and down there, and I could go down and drink. And no one would be standing at the door when I was coming in, waiting to see was I drunk or waiting to hear me come in. So I went down there, and I drank and I drank as much as I could while the money lasted. That wasn't too long. After a while, it wasn't lasting at all. It was sometimes I was leaving work and gotten paid on a Friday night, and every Saturday morning I wouldn't have any. I didn't know what happened to the money, and I couldn't remember. But one day I had a lot of drink, and I decided that I would go home, straight home. But on my way down to Grand Central Station, I didn't go into a bar this night. I didn't feel that good, and I hadn't been eating too good, because eating spoils your drinking very much so. I can't drink as much when I eat, so I didn't want to drink or eat. And I collapsed on the top of Grand Central Station and fell down 18 or 21 steps or something like that. And I could feel the steps hitting my head as I went down. And I was numb. And it was steel steps. And I don't know why, but only through the grace of God, I should have broken my neck. I don't know what saved me, but it definitely was the grace of God that saved me that night from breaking my neck. And a guy came up to me, and he said he was brushing me off downstairs, and he wanted me to go back to the hospital, and I wouldn't go. He said, you'll bleed to death if you don't go, and I didn't know I was bleeding. And I got on the subway against his will or his wishes, and with a crowd of people, you know. In no time I had a place to sit down. Everybody moved away when they saw me. I was covered with blood. And when I was up in the Bronx, this lady came over to me and said, what happened to you? And I said, I fell. She said, you've got to go to a hospital. She said, or you'll bleed to death. And then I realized that maybe I was bleeding to death, or what happened. And I looked down, and my clothes were covered with blood, and there was blood on the floor. And there were three or four ladies came around me then and ushered me out. And when I went out there, the kids brought me to the hospital. I showed me where the emergency room was, and this doctor put me up on a table and asked me what happened to me, and I said, I fell. And he said, were you drinking? And I said, yes. Now, he didn't ask me how much I drank, because he was probably too used to this. Because anybody who ever asked me, is a doctor or anybody important, I would say, just a couple of beers. And, I guess he had plenty of experience with this. But he did stitch me up, and I didn't want him to stitch me up. And he said, why? Because I said, it'll leave a mark, and then my family down in Brooklyn will know that I was drinking. And he said, they know already, don't worry about it. He said, if you don't sit down, he said, I'm going to strap you down. And I didn't like the idea of a strap somehow or another, and I said, okay, I'll try. So he said, sit on your hands and lie on this, and he said, you won't feel a thing. So he was right, I didn't feel stitches at all. I had no feeling whatever. And the next day, I went out anyhow, and the next day I went down to the hospital again to get myself examined, because I asked her to come down for an x-ray. So I went down there, and they told me there was nothing broken, but that I would have to stay home from work. So I called them up and told them I'd be in a week's time. I went back to the hospital again, but they would not take off the bandage. They had my face was blue and brown, and I had a big turban around my head, and my eye over here was bandaged, and I had to go in this way to work. And I was ashamed of my life going in there. I was hoping something would happen, that I would not have to go in there, but I did go in. And it's strange what God has in store for us alcoholics. Because that day I heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. My other boss, who was not an alcoholic, brought me inside and he sat me down and he said, I hope this is a lesson for you. And I said, I slipped and I fell. He said, well, you know, you're drinking too much. I couldn't say no, because I knew he just hit me straight with it, and I couldn't say no, and I said, I guess I am, but I'm going to join the pioneers in the Bronx. Now, the pioneer movement is another pledge that you take an island, and that's the only way the only way they try to get around alcoholism was to take this pledge. And he said to me, there's an organization. No, he said, I don't think a pledge will be any good for you. I didn't know what he meant. I had no idea what he meant. He said that I'll get somebody to talk to, he said, and there is an organization called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I go there and bring people there, and I bring people into the hospital, I bring them home again, I bring them to AA meetings, he said, and they're lovely people, he said, and you love them. Well, that was nice. I couldn't say no, I wouldn't go, so I said, yes, I'll go. So he said, okay, somebody will talk to you this afternoon. So a guy came to me, he was butchered in that same place, and he said to me, I heard you want to stop drinking, and I said, yes, I do. And he said, okay, I will meet you in the automat on Wednesday night, and we'll go to a meeting. And that was the meeting in the group that I still belong to. And I said, I have an appointment on Wednesday night. And the only appointments I ever had, really, was in a bar. So he said, well, so no harm, he said, we can go the next night. And I said, why is there a meeting the next night? Oh, yes, he said, we have meetings every night. I said, well, what nuts are your meetings every night for? He said, you come and see. So, and I said, this was Tuesday night, I was going to go out. I have a good drunk on Tuesday night. So I went out to have a good drunk. To have a good drunk, but I only got two beers. I got frightened. I got afraid. It had stopped me from drinking already, this going to AA. And the next morning I came in and I called him and I said to him, I'm going to go to AA with you tonight. So I remember meeting him in the automat and the two of us went up to St. Jude's Church up in Upper Manhattan. And he pointed me, see those two red signs out to the door, red A's. I said, yep. Well, he said, that's where the meeting is. And I prayed that night, very fast, in my own mind, please, God, let me fall off the footpath, until I break my leg and I won't have to go in. And God didn't happen to hear that. But I had to go in. One guy said to me, are you having a problem? I said, no. And he said, well, you want to stop drinking? I said, well, I don't know, because my boss thinks I should. Well, he said, maybe your boss is right. Why don't we go in anyhow and just listen to what goes on? So I went in to listen to what goes on. And you know, I was surprised when I went in. It wasn't what I expected. I asked in a bar what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I can tell anybody now, do not ask in a bar what is Alcoholics Anonymous. And it wasn't the Bowery, and it wasn't like that. My people I was living with, the guys I was living with told me, the priests and the nuns would be out there getting money off me, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous was. They had to pay the week. The nuns and the priests, and I said, well, whatever happens, I'm going to go through with this. So I went to that meeting that night, and on the way out, they asked me to come for a walk, and they walked with me, about five or six of them, and they all told me something, but I don't know what they told me. At the meeting, the guy asked me, I was leading the meeting, he said, what have you got to say? And I said, I have nothing to say, it's my first meeting. Oh, he said, don't... there's a few things I would like to tell you. I think that's the way he said. I haven't a proper memory of that, but I do know, he said, we stop drinking here one day at a time. And he said, it's the first drink that sets you drunk. And I thought, good God, what kind of people are these? One drink gets you drunk? My God, if that was me, I wouldn't have to come here. So he said, we don't, if you don't believe in God, he said, it's okay. He said, we put our trust in a higher power, and if we don't believe in God, you can make anything you want to a higher power. So I said, well, he's not going to tell me what to do. As far as religion is concerned, I believe in God, and this is a sect of some kind now, and I have everybody roped into it. And I had heard of these sects, but I didn't think that Alcoholics Anonymous was this. But anyhow, I went home, after they let me go, after telling me a lot of good things about AA, I suppose. And on the way home, I decided I could taper off. And if I tapered off and have three drinks tonight, two drinks the following night, and one the night after, that was it. If that's what they do, why can't I do it myself? It took me 2 years to taper off. And that was the worst 2 years in my entire life. I can tell anybody that's here, but there was no hands up from some people said there were new people. Nobody here said there were new. But every AA meeting should have one or two new people, because it is great to talk to the new people. If you are an alcoholic and you ever go to an AA meeting, you will never enjoy another drink. And I can tell you that for free. The Al-Anon people that are here don't have to worry about that, but don't worry about your husband or anything, because you have to let go of everybody and do your own thing, because otherwise you can't handle it. But anyhow, I called another guy when I was terribly sick, and my sponsor had gotten sick and died. I was glad he died at the time because I thought I'd never have to come back to Wei again. I went to his wake, and the people were out on the street and the wake, and they were all saying about this great man, how wonderful he was, and all the people he helped and all this. I said, what's wrong with these people at all in my own mind? I wouldn't talk to anybody that night. I was afraid they might say something to me. And I went out and I went down to a bar. And I was in and I had a Boilermaker. And as I looked around and I could see him sitting at the far end of the counter over there, my sponsor. I said, my God, he's here. And I looked back again and he was gone. And I thought, oh my God, I have to go. Really go. So I went home. And then I was in bad shape. I came in that few days to work afterwards. Not many, and I thought, well, the boss is the cause of that too, and only for I'm near Sing Sing, I would kill him. And I was getting terribly worried about the way I was thinking, and I wasn't able to walk, my feet were sore, my arms were sore, and I told him I was leaving. And he said, where are you going to? And I said, I don't know. He said, well, keep in touch. I said, okay. I spent a week someplace, and I don't know where I spent it, and it never came back to me. But the only thing I remember was, and the last night of my horror, I seen these things coming in the window. They were as big as seals, but they had frogs' heads on them. And they were singing. And somebody was playing the piano. And I could hear this piano going and all this lovely music. And I thought it was absolutely fantastic. And I wakened up and saw, oh, where am I at all? And cans and bottles and everything were strewn all over the place. And I went to the phone and I called the guy. And I got on my knees before I got to the phone and up against the bed. And then I asked God to help me for the first time, I think, sincerely. And I got into bed. And I didn't wake up until the following morning. When I jumped out of bed, I fell and I couldn't get up. My feet were just paralyzed. It wouldn't hold me up. And I don't know. Again, I got on my knees. And I was able to get up there after a bit and go to this phone and call a guy that I knew. And he said he'd come over, and I said, oh, don't come over. I didn't want him to see the house. And I said, I'll meet you tomorrow night. And we'll go up to St. Jude's to the Dykeman Group meeting. So he said, okay, I'll meet you on the bridge. So I went over to meet him on the bridge. And I met him, and he said to me, how are you? And I said, I'm not bad at all. He said, and I said, how are you? Oh, he said, good. I'm okay. Anyway, he said, that's the sly way he said it. I didn't like it, you know. But I said to him, how long are you sober? He said, 13 years. And I said, my God, how did you stay sober so long? He said, looking at people like you keeps me sober. And something happened there. Something clicked. And I said, I hope he never says that to me again. So I went home that night and I went into a bar that I was in the habit of going into. And I arrived in that bar. I don't remember going in, but I arrived in it. But I came to at the counter with a Boilermaker before me. And I looked around. I saw all these people sitting every place around the floor. And it was some place I had never gone into because it was a bar of low repute. And I was so big shot, I wouldn't go in there. But when I looked at it, and I suddenly thought, my God, what I have gone through, what am I doing here? And all of a sudden, the whole fog that I was in lifted from me. And I was clear. And I could think clearly. And I walked out and I said, thank God I'm home. And I walked away from that bar and left it behind me. And I never needed to go in for a drink until today. And I never had even a desire to go in for a drink until today. Maybe the first week or so I had a desire, but I knew what a desire would do for me if I took it up. But I never had any very, very bad desire. So I took the advice of my sponsor and of the people in the groups. Go to a meeting every night. If you drank every day, you're well able to go to a meeting every night. My boss came up and he got me the job back. And he told me, which was very nice, that I didn't have to come in the morning. I could stay out half the day if I wanted to. But if I got to a meeting every night, that was sufficient. He would make it okay with any of the boys that were there that I was to come in late that day. And he said, nobody will say anything to you here. So that was great. Nobody ever did say anything to me. It was just great. I thought the whole place changed. I was telling them at the group one night about how all these people had changed towards me. So he said, it isn't them that have changed, it's you. And probably was, because I was causing an awful lot of trouble and didn't know I was. And I went along to the meetings all the time, but something happened to me nearly 2 years after I stopped drinking. Don't want to be here all night. I was very unhappy, and people were good in AA. There were always those people who were very happy, and I was smiling and saying, how are you, and hitting me on the back and saying, oh, you're doing a good job and all this kind of thing. But these are the people that were doing a good job, not me. But I began to change against them, and I didn't like them so well. So I knew there was something wrong somewhere, and I didn't know where it was. So I there was a priest in Fordham University who I had seen going to the meetings, and I heard him talk. And he had just come out of a guest house in Michigan. And he was talking about steps. So I went over to him, I called him up, and I made an appointment. I went over to him, and I told him about the way I was feeling. So he told me, you know, you have a threefold disease. And I said, yes, I know. He said, you might say you have, but you don't believe one bit of it. You might know you have it physically, he said, but how about the mental and the spiritual? And he was right. I didn't have any knowledge of the mental. I didn't know I was mentally sick. Not for about 2 years going to set meetings, I began to remember that I was mentally sick. I began to realize I was mentally sick. And then he asked me to come to a meeting the following night downtown New York. And I met him down there, and he just said, how are you? And that was all there was about, no more, no paraphernalia, no nothing. Which I was glad of, because I didn't want to be too pally with him. I thought he might be forcing me into doing things that I didn't want to do. And I would be standoffish as I could, because he was too educated for me, and he was too strong. And he'd be make me maybe go to meetings that I didn't want to go to. But I was still going to a meeting every night. Well, people up in our own place, when I told them I was going to step meetings downtown, they told me I shouldn't go to these step meetings because they'll get you drunk. And now this was another thing. And the will to go down to step meetings was greater than the will to stay with the other guys. So I kept going. And slowly but surely I began to come together. And then they talked about service. I went to intergroup, and I answered the phones for about 13 years there. That was a great job for me, because I just loved doing it. They gave me the first job in the group was, I asked them if I could make the coffee. I don't know if anybody else asked your group, can you make coffee, or could you make the coffee? But they gave it to me without any trouble whatever. And I kept that for 2 years. And that was one of the best jobs I ever did. I think every job I did in AA was one of the best jobs I ever did. Because no matter what you do, if you want to do it well, you like it. And I really kept with this. And then they made me a GSR once. I didn't know what that was about at all. When I went to my first assembly, I thought they were going to slew each other. And I don't know what it was about. And I didn't, but yet, it was funny. You know, I can't imagine that. How could they be going to slew each other in 1 minute, and in 2 minutes' time they were having coffee together? I couldn't understand all this. And I kept coming back to these meetings all the time, because there was something there. And then I became a GSR. I became a GCM. And as you have here, very same way, I also joined the institutions committee with intergroup. And I did all this at the one time. It was nothing was too much of a load, because the GSR only was every 3 months. And then when I was at intergroup, I went down every day when they called me. And I loved doing that, because it was great to be talked to somebody, a live drunk. It was great to talk to a live drunk. And that is what helped me a lot. We miss that today, particularly in New York. I do know you have some 12-step work here. But we don't get any. I haven't gotten a call from New York intergroup for over 15 years. For a 12-step call. And anybody answering the phones down there tell me the only calls they get is inquiring about where's this meeting. And now I don't know what's going to happen. We miss all this activity that we had before. Since the treatment center started and a lot of other things started, I think people and companies are using that rather than using us. After I was GSR, I was allowed to be delegate for Southeast New York. That's when Rita said she met me. I don't know. And it was great. I loved being delegate. I think it was the greatest thing I ever did. I got out to the groups. I told them about what service was. I gave them service meetings, and they had never had any before. I had no car, and I went on the train, and they left me home. And I didn't have any problem. Nothing ever seemed to tire me. I had really a lot of energy to burn. But I was willing to do it too. And then, the best of it all is one night, someday, somebody asked me, would I like to put my name in to be director on the Grapevine board? And, I said I would, but, you know, I'm not going to be director. Nobody will ask me. But anyway, I got a call about 1 o'clock in the morning. From Rita telling me that I was elected to the Grapevine board. I was speechless, really, because I didn't know what to do. and I didn't know what all this was going to be. But we had a good time, and we had some sad times on that board. There were some sad times, and a lot of different things went on, and a lot of good things went on, too. And it was an experience that I think I never would like to miss now, that I had that experience. I would have never known about it had I not been on that board. So. And then I was elected for another 4 years to the Board of Trustees. And that's another experience altogether. But it's kind of different to the service you will do in the areas. A lot different, as a matter of fact. We all know everything. Everybody knows everything, you know. And when we all know everything, it's terribly hard to get anything done. And it's frightening sometimes. But that's finished now. And I think what I'm going to do, and what I like to do now, if I will, I did join the treatment center, the treatment committee. Now, I think we have a big problem with people coming from treatment centers out to our groups. They talk about bridging the gap. And I don't think a lot of people understand about bridging the gap. They don't seem to understand in our place about bridging the gap. But I'm going to try to do, anyhow, I keep at it, if something happens, is that I will try to get in there to the treatment centers to talk to the alcoholic, to tell them about Alcoholics Anonymous, to tell them what it's all about. Give them my name and address and telephone number and tell them I'll meet them when they're coming out and make it a regular thing to go into these treatment centers. We have loads of them around. And I naturally, we cannot tell the treatment centers what to do. So they give their own version of alcoholism. And we have a recovery program. We're not talking about alcoholism in AA. We're talking about recovery. And our primary purpose here is to recover, to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And we like to see them when they come into AA. We don't like to lose anybody. We don't like to see anybody going out. None of you out there like to see a friend going out and drinking again. It's like losing somebody belonging to you. And you know, if you're a long time sober and you go out, you may never come back in. And this sword is over our head continuously. And AA has been very, very good to us. People say that maybe we shouldn't do any cooperation with the professional community on that committee, that we are promoting AA. But then when you go back and read, AA comes of age from the very beginning, where Bill and Dr. Bob, when Dr. Bob stopped drinking on June 10th, 1935, the next day they were out in the hospital looking for people to talk to. And that's just what we are doing. We are making ourselves available that somebody will call us, hopefully, that they will call us and that we'll be able to give them the message that we got ourselves. And I think maybe I have talk too long, I guess I have. But anyhow, it was great talking to you, and I think in Toronto, I think it was in 1960 or 1965, I forget now, when they had that responsibility, the Declaration of Responsibility. When anybody anywhere look for help, I want the hand of AA to be always there, and for that I am responsible. Thank you.